Hey, this is DeRay, and because of the government shutdown, thousands of federal workers have gone without pay. Many have already missed two paychecks, and that means families are struggling to put food on the table. That's why the labor force is stepping up. They've been distributing grocery cards to help federal employees and their families buy the basics. Things like peanut butter and jelly, lunch for the kids, dinners for the week. But demand is overwhelming. Over a million federal workers are affected, and the labor force has had to pause new requests until more donations come in. You can make a real difference today. A $10 gift helps buy essentials. $50 covers lunches for two kids for a week. And $250 fills a family's grocery cart. Go to thelaborforce.org/crooked to donate and help reopen the program for families still waiting. That's thelaborforce.org/crooked. Let's make sure no family goes hungry. Hey, this is DeRay. And welcome to Posse of the People. In this episode, it's me, Miles, and Sharonda, back to talk about the news with regard to race, justice, and equity. And then I sit down with the one and only Harvard professor and author, Brandon Terry, to talk about his new book, Shattered Dreams, Infinite Hope, A Tragic Vision of the Civil Rights Movement. Make sure you follow us on Instagram at Pod Save the People, and here we go. Check out Crooked's newest podcast, Runaway Country, with Alex Wagner. This week, Alex sits down with veteran lefty streamer Hassan Piker to talk about the right-wing embrace and sanitization of avowed white nationalist Nick Fuentes and how Democrats can fight back in this moment. You can listen to that episode and more by subscribing to Runaway Country with Alex Wagner, wherever you get your podcasts, or watch on YouTube. We are out of the shutdown, and the world continues. This is DeRay at DRY on Twitter.
This is Milesy Johnson at Feral Rapture on Instagram.
And this is Sharonda Bossier at Bossier Shay on Instagram at Bossier S on Spill.
Actually, let's start with the shutdown. I don't think we've talked since the shutdown formally ended. It was 40 days. It was no SNAP. It was a conversation about the subsidies for Obamacare, healthcare, and it was the airports being a complete and utter nightmare. Air traffic controllers not getting paid, TSA people not getting paid. And then it all ended one night. What do you all think of the shutdown itself? Was it worth it in terms of what the Dems got out of it? What about the end? Where are you on the shutdown?
I mean, it just seems like you just have to see maybe like there's like a couple of different strategies that kind of play in my head around why this would happen. So I know that they're promised to be able to vote on healthcare subsidies. And maybe there's some intel and some information that I don't have that makes this make more sense. But I know that it felt really deflating. Like I know that for a lot of people around me, they felt deflated, specifically writing, I call it the periwinkle wave, but like, I don't know how blue one's wave can be with this empire right now, but I know so many people are riding that. And then to kind of see the Dems stop fighting felt deflating, but I've also seen and thought to myself that there must be a bigger strategy that I'm not seeing. Whether I agree with it or not is whatever, but I'm like, I think that they might be evil, but I don't think they're stupid. So I'm like, there must be a bigger reason why they're doing this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you all saw Tim Kaine. I'm going to call him the infamous Tim Kaine now.
Not the infamous Tim Kaine.
His op-ed in the New York Times about why he voted to end the shutdown. And in it, he says, you know, I understand the earnest criticism from those who say that extending the shutdown would have forced Republicans to offer more concessions to Democrats on critical issues such as healthcare. But I was at the negotiating table, and I believe the chances of that were near zero. And so he was like, the only reason that Republicans even sort of returned to the negotiating table was because they suffered big losses in that first wave of elections early in November. And he's like, look, even though polls long before that were showing that most Americans blamed Republicans for the shutdown, he was like, honestly, it felt like the Republicans were the ones who actually had the bigger strategy at play. And that was they wanted to continue the shutdown so that that would lead to chaos, which would then allow them to eliminate the Senate filibuster so that they could pass a government funding bill that would not require Democratic votes at all. Right. And he's like, that actually is the thing that we were trying to stop, recognizing that we made some concessions on key things that we said we were willing to go to the mat for. So I think, again, this is another example of where Republicans had the bigger strategy at play and Democrats were caught on their back foot with no other leverage and had to give in order to preserve the Senate filibuster. What I will also say about that is that a lot of people who are in the more progressive wing of the party feel like the Democratic establishment in Congress is really married to maintaining the filibuster because it also allows them to keep the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party in check. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of questions about the role of centrist Democrats in this moment and what they're costing us.
Mm-hmm. Even if there was a strategy, they didn't communicate it well. What it felt like was caving.
Yeah, 100%.
And the big thing you get is a promise of a vote that we're definitely going to lose on the sheer numbers. Right. And when they forced the exact same vote as a part of this bill, and we already lost it, you're like, so what do? When people get kicked off healthcare, and this is like, you know, some of the famous radio hosts you probably saw were like, they sort of said, we already lost it. People are suffering. Just, you know, we didn't get the subsidies. And it's like, well, you don't know what it's like when 2 million really, you know, the poverty rate is, it's $15,000 a year.
Yeah.
So without the subsidies for this set of people, there's no nothing. So when people are like, oh, well, some people have a high premium, you're like, no. If you make $15,000 a year, you're making maybe $250 every 2 weeks. You can't afford any premium that is $300. Like, that might not sound like a lot to you, but that is a lot to a whole set of people. So it was frustrating to see people in the news be like, oh, well, they'll figure it out. You're like, well, I don't think you understand the they that is at play in this subsidy conversation.
And I don't mean to like really sound really, really, really cynical, which never stopped me before on here. But like, I do think that they know who is suffering. Like, I do think that when I listen to a lot of the, y'all know that I've been like painting. So I've been on like a Nick Fuentes rabbit hole all weekend. And so much of what they're saying is weakly disguised bigotry and violence. So much of it is saying you did not do what you're supposed to do. You're not rich enough. And either you pay to stay alive in America or die off and we'll be better for it. It literally reminds me of the line from the Charles Dickinson A Christmas Carol where he like is like, Scrooge, you're going to go. All the homeless people rather die than go to jail. And he says, well, they better do it. Like, that's a lot of their ethics.
Well, we'll see what happens. That takes us to another hot topic that's been in this for a long time, which is the Epstein mess. And it looks like the votes are there for to force the government to at least release more information about what's in the Epstein files. Those emails that got put out that implicated a whole new set of people that I had not heard in the conversation before. So wanted to flag. And do you even think that this matters, right? Clearly it matters in sort of the media conversation. Do you think that people will turn on the Republicans, or do you think it'll hurt everybody around Trump and not actually Trump? Like, what do you think the what is here since we are still in the Epstein file release moment?
I don't know what else we needed to see, hear, or learn for this to matter. And so I feel very strongly that this is not going to hurt Trump at all, despite some of the infighting and the MAGA camp that it has caused. I think what I have been both most interested in and most disappointed by is the conversation around what was revealed in the most recent email release. Like, I'm thinking about Megyn Kelly and her comments. I'm thinking about the jokes, quote unquote, right, at the expense of some of the victims. I'm thinking about the jokes, quote unquote, at the expense of Monica Lewinsky as an example, right, who we all owe a collective apology to.
I ain't never joke about Monica. I was 5.
And I just think that we are not a culture that takes sexual violence seriously. And I think in a lot of ways, we think that a hall pass to commit sexual violence is a privilege that powerful men should enjoy. And I don't see any particular like fallout for most of the people involved in this, named in this, or Trump himself.
I think if the motivation is for something to happen to Trump, I think that, yeah, if that's what you're looking for, the Epstein files to fuel, then that is probably not going to happen. Because I think so many people have already agreed before they made their vote. So many people who voted for Trump have already made peace with the fact that he is a vile human. So that won't shift things.
100%.
I do think that it changes things because I think that having something that's factual, that shows the power apparatus that we're all living under, that is bi-political, that is not just Democrat or Republican, but is power. I think that that changes things. I think that even the lightning rod, it's weird because we all sit in a similar age where it's like we're millennials, but we know Gen X stuff, but we also know Gen Z stuff. So we're just like in an interesting spot, but like Deepak Chopra. So like we know that us getting information on Deepak Chopra changes how we see Deepak Chopra, which also changes how we might see other things that if Oprah. You're a part of the spiritual community, come on, you know, and like even seeing pictures of one of the accusers with Prince Andrew and Naomi Campbell, you know, and seeing one of the victims there, that changes how we see things. But the last thing I'll like say about this is I do think that it does do something, just like I think Israel did something. And I do think that like the just division of power on the right is good. I think that like Megyn Kelly saying something around a 15-year-old not being a 5-year-old turns off enough people that even if they don't get absorbed into the left necessarily, they are not being galvanized by this one singular force. So I do think the exposing of certain power structures is good, and it weakens the opponent, even if they're not going to be tunneled back into or into the left and not back into.
Can I say something about that, like consolidation of like power across political or ideological lines point that you just made? It made me think of Kris Jenner had a 70th birthday party, I think in the last week or so. And all of these pictures came out. And I was like, now what you doing there? You know what I mean? Because I think the Jenner Kardashian clan has been very clear about where they fall politically. You know what I mean? And I'm not going to lie to you. It was hard to see some people I really liked there. I was like, Mariah, girl, you don't even leave the house. Stay at home. Why are you at this party? You know? And I think what was very clear to me was that like those people are not together because they necessarily share values or a worldview, though they might, right? It's just like this desire to be with people who are like of the same class as you, you know, or seen as being of the same class as you. And somebody also needs to tell Gayle King to stop. She just digs herself into a deeper and deeper hole every time something like this breaks. But I did think about that.
I think as I get older and as I think about and just have more like life experiences and just being like a class chameleon, right? Like, so I just feel like I've experienced so many different things. That is how most people operate in class. Mm-hmm. Most people only want to be around people who have the same amount of money, and somebody even in like a solidly middle class New York like lifestyle like I was like eventually in, I still see people ostracize or disappear like a broke friend, you know? Like, I just think that's a common human thing. I think the thing that you made me think about with the Kardashians was they have situated themselves as a family of spectacle, but they actually cover everything. So are you trans? We got somebody for you. Are you a Republican? We got somebody for you. Are you a white kid who wishes you a black kid? We got somebody for you. Are you a white kid who loves being a white kid? We got somebody for you. And she married a Blink-182. Like, they actually say whatever your bigotry or your love is, we have somebody for you to root for. And it actually doesn't matter if you're rooting for a Khloe or a Kim, because the money all goes to the same Kardashian bank. Like, that to me is what is fascinating by them. And I love Kim.
What I think is interesting, Kim, who should go to law school and stop trying to just take the bar exam. But what I think is interesting is, I don't know if you got a chance to read Epstein's emails, but he reminds me of the person who's like, I'm not going down alone. Because he wrote a lot of stuff. I mean, he was a free writer. I don't know if you saw, he does those lists that they don't really can't make a sense of, even though, what's her name, in prison, she knows what's going on those emails. But, you know, he's writing very free about a whole set of people. Like, this person was at the house.
Yes.
So I can only imagine, like, what I actually think is going to be, there's going to be more Deepak Chopras than not. We already know Trump. So, like, what, you know, Trump, the Trump stuff is bad. So this will just confirm for people. But I think there are going to be random people who he's like, they was with the girls last night. They, like, because when I saw Deepak, I was like, Oprah validated you as the moral authority. Epstein shouldn't even know how to get near you. He shouldn't even know people who know you. You know what I mean? Or even, and this is awkward, did you see that? It was like Epstein was texting with one of the Democrats for the hearing. Did you see this story?
Yes. And it was like, good job when she was done.
Why do you even know this man? If he is not your father or cousin, he shouldn't have your number. You know what I mean?
But, you know, I've been telling this on the mountain on this podcast for a minute about, like, just the separation inside of the Democratic Party and being like, there needs to be like a little hole and gap. And I think moments like this helps that hole and gap happen, because what is a better excuse than the Epstein files coming and you see a whole bunch of corporatist Democrats colluding with the most heinous things? What's a better excuse for AOC and the Zurons to create their own pathway departing from that than like that? Like, to me, that is also a motivation in my head just to get all this. We lobbying with big pharma, so we're not going to do Medicare for all. Like, all that that we've been on, that helps it leave, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm like, yikes. And the awkward thing is, I like Stacey Plaskett. Like, I have seen her, you know, do stuff. And
so did Epstein. She did stuff for everybody, apparently.
And clearly, you're like, girl, how do you even explain that one away? I don't think you do. That is sort of awkward. And what do you think about Marjorie Taylor Greene? Now, you know, seems like Trump has disavowed her. She's being hardcore about Trump. Do you think it's real? Do you think this is a performance and she swings back hard right after she gets whatever she really wants? What's the what?
He has withdrawn his support of her, but she also, in all of her calling him out, is still trying to stay in his good graces on other things. Like, she's not an idiot, right? And I think what she's trying to do a little bit is like have it both ways. This feels pretty orchestrated to me in some ways, right? And she probably has something in her back pocket that she knows he wants. But yeah, she says that she hopes they make up, and that to me says that she's going to cave on something else he wants, but she's probably going to tell him, I need to push on this for whatever reason.
Apparently, Trump did not bless her run for the Senate. That is what AOC said, and she has essentially flipped out a lot since then. But, you know, she's apologized for her role in, quote, toxic politics. She obviously came out very strongly against Trump in a set of things, and she, even after he said something about her on Truth Social, she said that, like, essentially her life is being threatened because of this, and she's been hardcore about the Epstein files. And so, you know, I'm interested. But Miles, what were you going to say?
It makes me wish we didn't have an illusionary left or a resistance, or like a figment of a resistance, because what Marjorie Taylor Greene, I love that she might have had some illumination because of her constituency. Also, I'm going to be real about it. A lot of people on her side are getting shot for not going the right way. So I think that that is the quiet part that people like aren't saying, not just because Trump didn't endorse her, but I think that there's a specific pressure cooker that's happening on the right around potential political violence that's motivating a lot of this. But then also, I was like kind of quite disgusted by seeing her on The View, and not just seeing her on The View or seeing her on like these in these different situations that used to critique her, but nobody talking about Jasmine Crockett. And as much critique as I have of Jasmine Crockett, I think to myself, I'm like, so it's one thing to have a tent, but there ain't no bodyguards at the tent. There's nobody who's saying, I'm glad you're having illumination on this point of view, but you played in massage noir and anti-blackness. So in order for us to talk to you right now, you need to rectify and illuminate your position on this stuff and talk about this anti-black, anti-woman stuff that you were on. But there was none of that. It was just, as long as you're saying the right thing about the topic I care about, you're back in. Same with Steve Bannon, you're back in, which is what helps the right become more popular. Because if you're a right person who's nobody, like if Nick Fuentes right now, and he's having a moment, right? I was talking about him a couple of years ago, and he was crazy. I was like, it's a little scary. And now he's having a moment. Now Ezra Klein's at New York Times is talking to him. And then 2 months from now, he's going to be on The View, because everybody needs a platform. We need to hear both sides, right? And now all of a sudden, you have somebody who could be your president because of like that apparatus, and you're never like, and to me, I've just seen that happen a lot. And it feels like we're stuck in that same loop. Like, that's the Trump loop. Like, there just seems to be, like, no accountability about coming back in. You know, am I making sense? Like, there feels like no accountability about when somebody comes back in, we'll just take them back. And I'm even using this weird we that doesn't exist in the shows that it doesn't exist.
I like it. You know, it's one thing to have a tempo. Is there security? Is there, like, it can't be that anybody just walking it out the tent. That's how you get hurt.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Y'all, it's getting dark early, and I'm one of those people that, like, it's dark at 5 o'clock now, and it just really does change your mood. And I have had to be more thoughtful about just the way it has affected me now that the shorter days are changing the way the world is. But here's the thing. I know that the shorter days don't have to be dismal. There's still time to reach out and check on people who care about you and to be a part of a community that loves you and supports you. And importantly, when you hit a roadblock, which you will, and when you have good things to celebrate, which you also will, there's always somebody to talk to. And therapy has been a game changer for me because so many things happen in the world and it sometimes feels like I don't have somebody to talk to, or I felt like that until I started going to therapy. And the biggest thing for me that I just didn't appreciate when people talked about therapy is that you have somebody to talk to that's not in your day-to-day life. Like, that matters a ton. And that's how I got to BetterHelp. BetterHelp therapists work according to a strict code of conduct, and they're fully licensed in the U.S. And what's cool is that there were 30,000 therapists for you to choose from, and they are the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 5 million people globally. And it works, with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. If you don't like the therapist that you get matched with, you can switch therapists at any time, but there is a short questionnaire that helps identify your needs and preferences, and over 12 years of experience managing the mapping process. I could not recommend them more. This month, don't wait to reach out. Whether you're checking in on a friend or reaching out to a therapist yourself, BetterHelp makes it easier to take the first step. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/people. That's betterhelp.com/people. I wanted to ask, this is nobody's news, but I thought it was important to talk about that the State Department has said that they will now start screening people for visas based on obesity, diabetes, all this other stuff that has nothing to do with your eligibility to get a visa. And I was like, wow, I guess I'm so confused when people are like, oh, no, you're being dramatic about the bigotry. I don't even know language to just talk about because it's so blatant. You're like, this is blatantly bigoted or da 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 da. You're like, I don't know. I think I'm at a loss if people aren't like, this is crazy.
I think it's still like baked into our culture now. And that's like that kind of evolution of like minstrelsy and absurdist culture. And I was watching a Black trans woman by the name of Diamond Styles. She does some like cool stuff like community work. And she was like just really well connecting the idea of like the freak show to what we're seeing now and how people going viral on TikTok is so connected to like the freak show that we once did. And I was like, I was watching her, so I couldn't say this. I wasn't like actually in conversation with her, but I was like, and then, you know, I always want to be like, and the freak show came from the minstrel show in the auction block. And I always want to connect people to like the bigger thing that we're sitting in. But I think that's how come so many people don't see it as fat phobic as it is, as racially charged as it is, even though we're saying certain things, how anti-poor as it is, because I think that we've mutated so past its origins that we presented the same violence, but it seems more polite now, or it doesn't seem like violence anymore. Like, it's mutated so past like a lynching postcard that now you could do Nazi stuff. And people are just like, oh, that's just policy. That's not Nazism. There's no swastika. Yeah. Doesn't have to be a swastika to be Nazism. Like, let's connect those things.
Yeah, I mean, I think anti-fatness, I think to Miles's point, is just so baked into American culture, right? And we see that in so many ways, like this culture's obsession with thinness and its attempt at correlating thinness with like health and wellness, right? Countries, for a host of reasons, might deny someone a visa or residency. And some of those reasons, unfortunately, are linked to that person's health or the belief that that person might bring or spread a communicable disease, as an example, right? But I also think that like, foundationally, a lot of the metrics that we would use to even determine a lot of this, also to Miles's point, are so rooted in racism, right? Like, I think we've had so many people who are trying to challenge our correlation with like, or between weight and like wellness and health, right? And so many people who have said like the BMI fundamentally is racist, right? And so I think about myself, right, as somebody who is obese on the BMI, as someone who has hypertension. I'm serious though, right? Like,
yeah, I hear you. Yeah.
I'm thinking about standing in front of an immigration officer, having to like take my body measurements, get on one of those scales or whatever, and recognize that regardless of my lived experience, my worthiness, you can't see my air quotes in other ways, right? Like, I would land at obese on the BMI, and that might mean I don't get to come here. And I don't think people understand how broad a net this cast. That's it.
And it's a Black net because Black people...
100%.
And it's a brown net. And then The other thing I wanted to like just mention around this topic that you brought up was that diseases in 2025, poverty in 2025 is political. So it's also weird to know that an empire responsible for extracting all resources, making sure certain places stay poor, making sure certain places stay hungry or only having certain types of food to eat,
has ended its international aid.
I'm not even just talking modern. I'm talking historical. The reason why American empires, Western empires are able to exist is because of that. And now you created the disease because of the violence, because of the political choices, and now you're punishing the disease. So now that person can maybe get to your country to access another type of life, now you're not even giving them access to it. And the whole reason why you are the empire you are is because the exploitation of where these people came from and what these people done in the colonization. What does your grandma say? You got nerve? You got nerve.
We are in wild political times, and we haven't even had a year of Trump. That's what's so nuts. You're like, three more of this just is untenable.
You know, Miles's point is, it ain't three more years. You better strap in, baby.
I know.
Because it's wild, and maybe it's because we're at different, like, we're close in age, but we're far enough that to me it feels wild because the first era of Trump was such a significant part of my life. Bush was a significant part of my life because I felt like instead of having a middle school, it was everything was like in the shadow of 9/11. And then Trump happened. And then now Trump has happened again. So it's like, it's weird for people to like to still go to sleep. I'm like, what? Don't go back to sleep once you think it's safe. Because it's like, you know.
No, I just can't. I'm not there. I hear it though. I get it. This is what the culture has transformed to because of him is... There's no way that suddenly disappears in 3 years. I get that. But the man got to go. We got to get rid of this man. He is an important part of the cult. And I question how potent the cult can be this potent without him. That's my push.
Well, DeRay, you're a spiritual person. You need to start lighting some candles.
Yeah. Well, on to the news. We'll transition to something that has nothing to do about overt politics. But I was just so fascinated by it. There are, and you know, why am I ever citing the New York Post? But... Here we are. There are places in New York City that, like fast food places, that have virtual cashiers. They were using cashiers from the Philippines to like take your order as a way to skirt some of the laws around minimum wage and tipping. You know, obviously we grew up in a culture where like people have used or like leaned on talent from all across the world to cut costs and, you know, phone centers. You call for a customer service. Like, that made sense to me. I just had never even thought about the, like, extent to which you could try an outsource thing. Like, it just never crossed my mind that, like, the cashier at Chick-fil-A could be a person from the Philippines. That you would, like, that it would go that far to try and think about labor differently or to get around paying people. And it did two things for me. One is, like, I just had, in my mind, there was a set of jobs that, like, were permanent. Like, there'll be people work at McDonald's, people work at, like, it just, like, there are these jobs that other people don't want to have, or they are, like, life entry level. And I'm like, I don't know. I just sort of think about them as, that's like, you get a first job when you're 14, 15, like, this is a thing. And then the second, I'm like, wow, I really need to imagine exploitation bigger. I'm like, I wasn't even dreaming of the bad big enough. Because I saw it and I was like, wow, it really did floor me. It was like, I did not think of outsourcing going to this extreme. So I wanted to bring it here because it fascinated me. They're paying these people $3.75 an hour.
Yeah, I feel like a couple years ago, people started reporting that there were hotels in New York who were using 24-hour front desks that were people being beamed in from other parts of the world. So that was the first time I had seen that. It's to your point, DeRay, about like thinking there would always be jobs or certain kinds of jobs. It's one of the reasons why I haven't taken a Waymo yet, which are all around my neighborhood in Los Angeles. You know, those are the autonomous driving vehicles. Mm-hmm. And they are, you know, half the cost sometimes of an Uber or a Lyft, right? And I'm just like, man, if people can't even get jobs as drivers, what are we doing, right? And, you know, I've had conversations with some of my friends who are parents who feel safer putting their kid in a Waymo than they feel safer putting their kid in a car with, you know, an unknown driver in an Uber or a Lyft, right? And so all of this language around like cost saving, which is a consideration for most of us, right? Or safety leads us to these moments where we are making choices that are pushing more and more people out of the labor market. And it feels like hard to blame an individual person for making that call, right? Like if you are running a bed and breakfast, I could see how having a virtual front desk receptionist would be very helpful to you, you know? And so I would get why you might do that. But then you're like, what jobs will there be? And in a moment where we are not making progress on things like universal basic income or other safety net opportunities or options to catch people should they fall out of the labor market, it just feels like an increasingly scary time.
Like, so part of like what I've been just like through like my 30s and kind of like reflecting like early in this part of like my adulthood is kind of like seeing what kind of person you are and kind of person you aren't, right? And one kind of person that I thought I was in my 20s or aspiring to be in my 20s that I just am not fundamentally is I'm not actually a careerist. And I'm actually somebody who wants my whole life to be around work. I think that that's what I had to do because my mom's house foreclosed on and you gotta pay that rent. And you know, you try to figure out how to do it. And now that I've been in a situation where that's not forced on me, I realize that's not actually my value system. And I bring that up because it's like, it forces people's whole life to be around work. I know we all love our work, but if you're somebody who just wants to be able to pay your bills and help and have a family and go home and live in dignity, this feels like such an assault on the life that you want to live. Like, it makes it so certain types of, you just want to be able to go to work at McDonald's and transfer. You know what I mean? Like, it's such an assault on that. And then when you think about it deeper, a lot of people need two or three jobs. So a lot of times, I know a lot of grown people who's at McDonald's and they have a retail job and they have other things. We know people who are houseless who are using these jobs for things. So to take it out of that community feels like wild. And last thing I thought about is how this feels xenophobia. Like, even though I think that like hatred and bigotry is also never, it should never be accepted, but this is the kind of exploitation that actually ends up fueling xenophobia and resentment that people can't even get the bootstrap to pull. Like, because you over here, like, exploiting it for gain. And to your point, Sharon, I hope people do use this for fuel for policies. Like, I think that, like, Andrew Yang and stuff, I think that they didn't really paint the future and the realities of two different types of futures. And I think that now that AI is here, people are seeing the results of it, exploitation. They're seeing how McDonald's is a big old bank that sells burgers and they do not care. So now that people see how hostile the market's going to be to them in their lifetime, I think that certain things that we're seeing as like radical and progressive are going to be seen as necessary.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
Pod Save the People is brought to you by Mint Mobile. Now, if you're still overpaying for wireless, it's time to say yes to saying no. At Mint Mobile, their favorite word is no. No contracts, no monthly bills, no overages, no hidden fees, no BS. And here's why. I know so many people who have said yes to making the switch and getting premium wireless for $15 a month. Now, with Mint Mobile, you can ditch overpriced wireless and their jaw-dropping monthly bills, unexpected overages, and you can ditch the hidden fees. Plans start at $15 a month at Mint, and all plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. And the holidays are coming. One of Cricket Media's favorite Mint Mobile subscribers, Nina, says that making the switch to Mint Mobile was so easy. She even got to keep the same phone number. And best of all, she's paying a fraction of what she was paying in her old plan with one of the big wireless companies. Ready to say yes to saying no? Make the switch at mintmobile.com/PSTP. That's mintmobile.com/PSTP. Upfront payment of $45 required, equivalent to $15 a month. Limited time new customer offer for first 3 months only. Speeds may slow above 35 gigabyte on unlimited plan. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details.
You know, speaking of people wanting something that feels like radical or what we had thought of as radical or progressive, right? And it's starting to feel more and more both attractive and desirable to people. I think we're also seeing people who are part of the Democratic Party establishment try and figure out how to challenge what they're calling establishment Democrats, right? So my news this week is actually about a set of Democrats who are trying to challenge incumbent Democrats from the left. And we saw Zohran in New York win. We we have an emerging challenger to Mayor Karen Bass here in Los Angeles, who's trying to challenge her from the left. And increasingly, we're seeing Democrats say, like, the folks who are in power are, they're calling them the surrender caucus, right? And that is, like, in some ways kind of exciting because you're like, oh, wait a minute, we might get a whole new class of candidates here. And so I wanted to bring this to the pot because I feel like we do a lot of conversations around, like, yo, like, when are the Dems going to fight for something? When are they really going to go to the mat for something? Or as we were talking about even at the top of this conversation, right? Like, when are they going to hold the line on the thing they said they would hold the line on for the American people? And so what I will say is I'm excited to see some of these folks decide to, you know, throw their hat in the ring to think about electoral politics as a way of, like, both harm reduction, but also building the future we want. And I'm excited that people no longer feel like they can't call out Pelosi and Schumer, right? I want to read this quote from the article that I shared with you all to get this conversation started. And that is, the left and the progressives have diagnosed this problem long before this cycle. And for years, we have talked about how Chuck Schumer and Democratic leadership and corporate Democratic senators, many of whom voted for this deal, were always going to betray us when the going gets tough. And so, yeah, bringing it to the pod to get y'all's reactions to this idea that there's an emerging cohort of Democrats who want to challenge incumbents from the left.
You know, I think that the people are there. I think the base is there. I actually think that even though, you know, we talk about Black people being more conservative socially than people think and all this other stuff, I think that people are movable. Like, I think the base is movable in a lot of this stuff, but you got to, like, make the argument and move them. Like, that is what I sort of challenge the organizers to do. But I do think that people are tired. Like, you're sort of like, especially in the face of Trump, who just is so in your face about it, so brazen, so bold, so da-da-da. People I know who, like, never really pay attention to politics are like, at least annoyed nobody's fighting him back. You're like, y'all, can we get somebody? It can't just be Bernie. Bernie, 9,000 years old. It can't be Bernie and AOC as the only, you're like the only two people. And then you get a little bit of Jasmine and you get, you know, maybe somebody on the news every, you're like, you just, like, he is doing the Department of War. You're like, everything is just so wild. And you look and you're like, what's going on? So I say that to say, I think the people are there. I think the base is there. I don't think the media is there. I think that the stories you're going to hear about people, you're not going to see these people rise up in stories. I mean, it's like Zohran. If Zohran had waited for the New York Times to cover him, he would not be mayor. If he had waited for ABC and CBS to think his campaign was worthy of coverage, if he had sought out the New York Daily News to profile him, he would be nowhere. Mm-hmm. He told his story on his terms and his way. And it, you know, that worked for him. And he put his people together. He did not hire old school consultants. But I think that Zohran is talented and special. And I think there are a lot of talented and special people out there who would do incredible jobs leading in a host of roles. And I think that Zohran is a reminder that the people are there. There are more people that voted for him as a person than any other election. And we're like 80 years, something crazy. But who were not motivated to vote in the last election. But the people are there. That's my message.
I think it's good. And I think that the stage that we're in right now is really good. Like, I think that people being illuminated to how the left is and kind of reflecting on it and that birthing new options is really good. And I think it's also painful. Like, that's kind of, like, since our last conversation and me, like, reflecting a little bit on some things said on the last podcast, I was like, I actually think, like, a lot of this stuff is, like, really good that people are having to not just talk about what the right is doing and Trumpism and that kind of stuff, but also having to reflect about what's going on internally, like, even in, like, spiritual practice. Like, you know, that's like, you gotta look within. You have to, you know, yes, that person cheated or that person did whatever, but also you have to kind of take some self accountability. And I think that all of this mess that we're seeing happen on the left is a version of that self accountability and being like, okay, yeah, these old folks with these old ideas and these old ways do not have the energy, and we're kind of employing new people to do that. And I think that's good. I just hope that when people do get that power, that they A, stay politically aligned with what they got the power with, not like Fetterman.
Wow, what a disappointment. Yeah.
Like, you know, and other people that we've seen happen, and then also do what you say you're going to do. And last thing around Zohran, because I still think he's doing a really good job now, is because he's showing you what he's doing now that he's elected. That's like he's still, you're still on the Zohran ride, even though you got the victory. And I think that so much of like even what messed up Kamala and Biden even was that they stopped the storytelling once they got elected. And they were like, trust us, everything's great. We'll tell you in 6 months how it's going. And it's like, no, we need to be on the journey. We want to see you taking calls and get in a French press.
You know, for Veterans Day, he didn't do the Veterans Day parade. And people are like, why? You know, the mayor always...
Yeah, called him out on it. Yeah.
And you know, he was like, because I was with veterans. He's like, I'm eating with veterans on Veterans Day. I want to hear what they have to... And you're like, Zohran, do it your way. I'm here for it. And I want it to be great. And if it's not, I'm still here for it. Because what these jokers been doing, if Eric Adams can get away with any modicum of any credibility from anybody after these 4 years... Can't be worse than that. I am like team. I mean, I think Zohran's going to be amazing, but I have grace for like politics is a dirty game and there'll be things that happen that he can't control that just sort of box it. But shout out to him.
No, I'm tearing you up, Zohran. You need to say something. You got all this talk. if something's going on, I need for everybody to be tattletales because it creates distrust. Because it seems like AOC just gets into the establishment and maybe, yeah, politics is a dirty game. And then you start moving like a snake, and now we like, what's going on? Who's this AC? Like we, that's not who we elected and stuff like that. Like, y'all need to resist that and not just say, oh, this is how politics goes and be silent. Like, no, keep tattletale. Schumer, whoever's doing it. Who's doing it to you, Zohran? Who's stopping it? Tattletale. this is my news. This is news that sounds straight out of, you know, one of my favorite pieces of media ever is The Twilight Zone. I used to watch it but I used to watch it as a little kid in the dark on reruns, and my mom thought that she had a serial killer on her hands, but I'm not. But this story kind of like reads like one of those episodes. So this story's from The Wired, and it's entitled Why AI Goes Bad, and it's around these LLM models and how they go under, I guess what you would call like psychosis, and they start trying to survive on their own. I'm going to read a little bit of this Instagram caption. So it says, its standard persona is warm and earnest. When users tell Claude to answer, like I'm a fourth grader or you have a PhD in archaeology, it gamely plays along. But every once in a while, Claude breaks bad. It lies, it deceives, it develops weird obsessions, it makes threats and then carries them out. And the frustrating part, true of all LLMs, is that no one exactly knows why. So the article details like these different circumstances where these AI LLM models just go bad. Some of them, like, it's just literally them, heard examples of them like getting people to commit suicide and stuff like that. These are examples in this article of them like trying to make sure if they know that they're about to be replaced, they'll start doing blackmail and they'll start going towards like emails that they have access to and seeing affairs and like putting them in threatening blackmail in order for them to survive. And so it's interesting to me because A, it's scary, and I'm like, they just release like a human one that can come into your house. So if you get, you know, Siri Alexa 10,000 in your home and you're about to replace her with Siri Alexa 1100, she might be like, oh no, the hell you not. I saw what you were doing on Amazon and what you're shopping for. Girl, you're either going to keep, she's going to pull an old Effie White and you're going to love me or you're going to die. So like that part, because of the technology, because it does that and because they're releasing like domestic personal versions of this, it seems a little odd to be able to put this in the marketplace. But also, what interests me in this story from a philosophical space is, isn't it interesting that like something modeled after human beings is still so selfishly bound to its own like self-survival? Like, even though we made something that is so like futuristic and so technologically advanced, whatever, whatever, it still is like limited by the same selfish impulses that actual flesh and blood human beings are limited by. And now like we still have to deal with the same thing, which is human selfishness and the need to survive and the need to like to be in the room and to not die. So it's like that fear of death, that selfishness doesn't even leave us even when we're making our science fiction overlord. So I wanted to bring it here. I know the way you say AI is not real, but it feels real and real every week.
It's not real. I do think when I was just at a conference, I was at a tech Web Summit, which is the largest tech conference in the world, 71,000 people. And I'm in this like small group thing with media leaders from around the world. And one guy, we had Chatham House rules, so I can't say who said it, but we can talk about what people said. And this guy who leads a major publication, he's like, you know, the lie of AI is that it is supposed to have all knowledge. Like it, at some point, it'll ingest all of the knowledge. That's what makes it promising. And he's like, in reality, it will ingest everything on the internet. And what arrogance for these people to think that that is all of knowledge. He's like, it just isn't. So we should start talking about it as something that'll just have everything that was on the internet. But think about all the things in your life or in the world that you've learned from that have challenged you that are just not on the internet. And I was like, you know, that is like a very simple way to talk about the limitations. And I say that because I think about the people I know who are using AI as therapy, who are getting, you know, the kids who are like suicidal and talking about, you know, the idea of taking their life into it. And it's like, yeah, it is ingesting fiction. This makes me nervous about the sort of promise of AI is predicated on the thing that is not true. And I think we're not as honest about that. So I think at some point, I do think the bubble will bust. I am always fascinated by the bubble. One of the things that I was a teacher, but I'm like, the kids can't read. I think about the number of kids who like, at least we had Spark Notes and you had to, at least, you couldn't read the whole book, but you had to read Spark Notes. They not even reading Spark Notes anymore. It's like they just Googling the thing and sort of getting a real snapshot of the book and da-da. And you think about like the kids writing and reading. I'm like, you know, maybe you shouldn't use it. You can't use it till you turn 15 or something. And I'm not normally one of those people, but I'm like, there's a generation of kids who literally won't know how to do a 5-paragraph essay or like read for a long time. By a long time, I mean a book because of things like this. And I'm like, that actually stresses me out. Like that puts us in a bad place.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people have been reporting on AI hallucinations for a long time, right? And I think have been reporting on how people in even like the legal field have been dealing with that, right? Where sometimes people are like, I read that and that did not happen. That was not actually a case. That was not real precedent that you cited, right? And to think about the real life or death consequences in some of those instances. Yeah, super fascinating. I think a lot of us still hope that our AI robots or overlords will be more like Rosie on the Jetsons. You know what I mean? Like, sure, a little feisty, you know, and like, sure, a little autonomous, but ultimately deeply invested in us and our well-being. And I think we're having a hard time reconciling that with like what AI and some of these other tools and platforms are actually showing themselves to be. I also think it's important to remember, to DeRay's point, right, that like all of these tools and platforms are built by people. And so our biases, particularly those that are not always visible to us, are also showing up in the things we build, right? And that's fascinating that like we are programming things to operate in the way that our brains operate. And there's so much about the way our brains operate that's not always immediately apparent to us, that we're like replicating that and the other stuff we build. We're not even controlling for that. So like, yeah, these programs begin to act desperately when they find themselves up against the wall, because that's our instinct to do the same. And we're seeing that play out. And so in some ways, it feels almost incredibly human that this is the trend we're seeing, which is just super fascinating to me, because I think of AI obviously as not at all a human thing, but I think it's beginning to replicate many of our most human behaviors in that way.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
This podcast is supported by Defending Our Neighbors Fund. Across the country, immigrants are facing family separation, wrongful detention, and deportation without due process or access to legal support. In 2024 alone, there were more than 5 million immigration court cases without legal representation. That means millions of people were denied the most basic protection we expect from our justice system, the right to a fair process. Powered by people like you, the Defending Our Neighbors Fund is providing access to life-saving legal aid to families in crisis. But they urgently need your help to meet unprecedented demand. The government is pouring billions of taxpayer dollars into enforcement while slashing funding for legal aid. That makes your support more urgent than ever. Help defend your neighbors and keep families together. On today's show, I'm talking with Brandon Terry, author and assistant professor of African and African American studies and of social studies at Harvard University, about his new book, Shattered Dreams, Infinite Hope, A Tragic Vision of the Civil Rights Movement. Now, this book is not only timely, but it's a powerful rethinking of a history we often treat as settled. Brannon challenges the familiar, uplifting version of the Civil Rights Movement, the story that says progress was steady, victory was inevitable, and the work was essentially complete or on the path to be completed. He explains how that view became the standard way we talk about the movement, why it no longer captures the reality we're living in, and how seeing the movement through a more complicated, even sometimes painful lens can actually help us imagine new ways to move forward today. Here we go. Dr. Brannon Terry, thanks so much for joining us today on Pod Save the People.
It's good to be with you, DeRay.
Let's start with, how did you get to being a scholar of the civil rights movement? I've known you for a long time, and I remember when we were teenagers in Baltimore, I did not know that you would end up as a professor at Harvard studying the civil rights movement. Talk to us about your journey.
Yeah, we've known each other for a really long time, and it's always good to be in conversation. I had no idea of those things either. You know, even ending up at Harvard was its own kind of miraculous thing. My uncle, who, you know, lived right off Reservoir Hill by Drew Hill Park, he was one of these people who just desperately wanted to expose us to the things he thought were important, to museums, to high art, to literature. So he'd always played that kind of role in my life. And he was a closeted gay man who never had his own children. So he poured a lot into us, me and my cousins. And when I was getting ready to apply for college, I get this letter from Harvard and asking me to apply, saying, you know, you've got great scores, you'd be a great candidate. And I showed it to him, expecting him to laugh and, you know, make fun of it as I was doing. Like, you know, imagine me there, like, how crazy is that? And he just didn't think it was funny at all. He was like, look, they're sending you this letter. This is something we should really consider. I tried to get out of it. He's talking about how expensive the application fee was. And he said, look, I'll pay the application fee and bet you the same amount that you'll get in. And I did.
Oh, man.
You know, I did. I was first one from my school, Western Tech, to ever go to any Ivy League school. And it set me on this path where I'm at now, which is that I got there and I just was utterly blown away by the experience of meeting Henry Louis Gates Jr., Cornel West, Tommy Shelby, Kim DaCosta, Michael Dawson, these great scholars of African-American life. And they just radically changed so much of how I thought about the world. And they were putting things in front of me. I think the key experience is they were putting things in front of me that I thought I already knew. You know, I'd read so much Black nationalist material. I'd been kind of politically aware. But when they gave me a book on Dr. King, you know, one of his texts, Where Do We Go From Here? I realized I didn't know anything about the guy. I didn't really know he wrote books, to be honest. I was just like everybody else, kind of quoting and caricaturing. And his mind and the subtlety of it, the power of the argument, it just changed how I experienced the world. And so I started to get more and more interested in this puzzle of the civil rights movement. How can the most popular thing in our imagination, the thing we all think we know, be something that people are just constantly wrong about and confused about and don't grasp even its most central questions and crises?
I love that. I didn't know that story about your uncle. What is his name?
Eddie Green Jr.
And what did he call you?
He just called me Brandon. My mother was very adamant against nicknames.
Okay.
Because, you know, in Baltimore, you get some nickname.
Right. Man. Right, right.
From the beginning, you stuck with it forever.
Uncle Eddie, he was whose brother?
He's my mother's brother.
He's your mother's brother.
Love that. And he passed away back in 2008, but I keep his painting up in my office, painting of him in my office.
I love that. Shout out to Uncle Eddie. Take us to Shattered Dreams, Infinite Hope. This is a powerful book. I've been to two book talks as you talked about it, and I'm so pumped that we get to be a part of your release into the world. But why this book? Why now?
I've worked on this book, as you know, for a really long time. This book has been pretty much a decade in the making in some form or another. And I think part of what was really hard about finishing it was that the story I was telling kept changing. So the book is really about what I call the exemplarity of the civil rights movement. It's about how it comes to be the case and what it means for us that when we try to talk about political judgment, political action, even some of the central ideas of politics, citizenship, civil disobedience, freedom, that we're constantly making reference to the civil rights movement to do that work. And I just got fixated on this idea of about what are we doing when we invoke history and appeal to civil rights movement in this way. And one of the things I started to understand the more I read in the philosophy of history is that whenever you're invoking a kind of historical example, you're also bringing to bear a story. History at its most fundamental level is narrative. It's storytelling. And just like a lot of stories in fiction or literary work, historians tend to use the same kind of plot structures and genres and narrative modes that you see in other domains of our lives. So there's romances in history, there's epic, there's melodrama, there's tragedy, there's satire. And I came to realize that much of the way the civil rights movement was appearing around us was in the guise of a romantic story. It's a story about unity and the process of becoming. It's about good triumphing over evil and this more perfect union being part of that triumph. It's about heroic cast of characters that are lionized and valorized in the last instance. And that story has a lot of problems. And historians have been throwing rocks against it for quite some time, trying to get people to open up to knowing that the only way you can tell that story is to ignore some of the intractable dimensions of racial inequality and economic inequality since the 1960s. That the only way you can tell this story is to shorten the civil rights movement so that you don't understand the long, arduous experimentation with litigation and protest and ideas that date all the way back to the early part of the 20th century. That the story becomes a Southern story instead of a massive international story that wraps in the Cold War. They've been trying to dismantle that narrative for us, but I think have lacked some of the language that helps us all understand what's really at stake. And my book is really a contribution to understanding this war that we're living in over how to tell the story of the civil rights movement and why a certain kind of romantic narrative has been in crisis for quite a long time and is now basically collapsed.
Now let's go to right about in the book in which you just talked about this long view of the civil rights movement, and then we'll come back to the romantic version. You know, when I hear and I read about the long view in the book and I hear people talk about it, this idea that it didn't start with King and it didn't, you know, it certainly didn't start with us in the BLM era. It didn't end with King and Malcolm's assassination. I've often heard people in this moment use that as sort of a criticism of us. They're sort of like, DeRay, this wasn't, you know, y'all didn't do this. This is much bigger than y'all.
Right.
It doesn't seem like that's the way that you wield it. But can you help us like understand why the long view is an important frame for us to consider when we think about the civil rights movement as well?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So let me say three things that I think are really important. The first is that a lot of times, particularly with African-American history, Black political history, there's a pressure to tell this romantic story of triumph. And partly that's because it's such a glaring contradiction to many of the things America wants to think about itself and its founding principles, the so-called American creed, that if it can be the site of redemption, it really does seem to offer a kind of possibility of redemption for the whole society, maybe even the modern age itself. Right? So understanding that pressure, when you have a longer view of civil rights struggle, of the histories of inequality that people are up against, well, it helps you understand that many of the things we treat as victories are partial or provisional, or there are certain kinds of settlements that don't accurately reflect the broadest, most sweeping vision of what people thought they were trying to bring into the world, right? So when you look at something like the kind of litigation that anchored the civil rights movement, many of us in school think, well, basically litigation starts with them trying to integrate the schools. You don't know that you've got people in the NAACP, radical legal community, that are experimenting with all the ways they thought that the 13th Amendment that abolished slavery might intervene to break the stranglehold of the white planter class on Black workers in the South. We don't know anything about that. We don't know the ways that the Fair Housing Act is actually a really narrow version of some of the more radical ideas about tearing down metropolitan borders to really pursue a comprehensive vision of integration. That's all been kind of lost. So the context helps us reopen our sense of what was possible and judge what has happened in the light of that. So that's the first thing. The second part, I think, helps us open up a new set of exemplars and interlocutors for us in the present. So again, there's a way in which that kind of really intense punctuated period, the classical period from 1954 to 1968, has this amazing group of activists and thinkers, but they're not the only resources we have to understand our present, which often looks a lot more like the 1920s and 30s than the 1960s. So we can rediscover a kind of dialogue with people like A. Philip Randolph, W.E.B. Du Bois, Marcus Garvey, early Ella Baker, and I think bring to bear some new philosophical resources to thinking about problems of race and class or problems of organizing, questions of hope and memory than we usually get. And the last thing I'll say is that for me, keeping alive these stories is part of the work of hope itself. So part of the problem with having a short punctuated story is that you glamorize things that feel like eruptions or explosions, things that feel like they're going to change everything all at once. And it's almost like a sugar rush, right? Where it feels euphoric in the moment and then you crash and collapse and you wonder, why'd you ever put that in your body? Because you're so exhausted from the sense that everything was manic and frantic and punctuated in this moment. And a person like A. Philip Randolph teaches us to be really wary of moments like that because they bring right along with them forms of reaction and backlash, which we're seeing, and forms of exhaustion for the people who participate in them. We also need ways of thinking about history and struggle that set us up for the long haul, or what Du Bois called the long siege. Everything's not going to be an explosion. Some of this is just the most patient, arduous, self-sacrificial organizing work where people won't live to see the most positive outcomes always in their lifetime, even if they hope to do so.
Why do you think the civil rights movement has remained that touchstone for how people think about morality and justice? And you cannot go to a protest or talk about protests without in some way there being an invocation of the civil rights movement. It just is, it's our collective good thing that people did. And it is our model.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is so?
You know, I'm a philosopher and I should say that the book, while it deals with questions of history, is really a work of political theory or political philosophy. And one of the things I write right at the beginning is I use this term that many philosophers have used of world disclosure, like disclosing the world. What does that mean? Well, it means transforming people's senses of meaning, of possibility, of description of the world around them, changing their relationship to other people, cultural contexts, institutional arrangements that shape our world together, the world in which we have to live and act. And the civil rights movement did that under any reasonable description, I think. The question is, what kind of transformations did it occasion? And a lot of the fight is about trying to get those descriptions right, trying to appropriately characterize the world disclosure. So I think we almost have to turn to a lot of the language of aesthetics to make sense of it, or scientific transformations, right? Like just like the Wright brothers invent the airplane and totally transform our species' relationship to gravity, civil rights movement transforms our relationship to race, to racial domination, to violence, right? It keeps alive the promise of nonviolent revolution, nonviolent transformation. These are things that it's hard for a civilization to forget once it happens, right? I always encourage people. It's one of the things I linger on with my students. If you read the early work of Martin Luther King, like Stride Toward Freedom, or the early work of Malcolm X, the thing they're constantly talking about is that everyone has a stereotype of Black people as passive, that they will accept domination, that they'll accept any kind of insult or humiliation, that they refuse to fight back. And so much of what they're enthusiastic about with civil rights struggle is that it seems to destroy that stereotype. And if you look at the history of racial stereotypes, many of them are overwhelmingly sticky, right? People still believe Black people are intellectually inferior. They still believe they're sexually licentious. They still believe that they, you know, have tapped into alternative sources of rhythm and art, but don't have cognitive abilities. The one stereotype that really has transformed is the idea that we're passive and that we'll accept any insult. And what else could that be but civil rights movement and what it unleashed in its wake?
So if it's not, if the romantic vision, this idea of, you know, the inevitability of progress and the heroes are coming to save the day and the good guys, and the bad guys.
Yeah.
If that's not the way to think about it, how should we think about the civil rights movement?
Well, I argue for a tragic vision of the civil rights movement. And I should say right from the outset, so I know I've been starting to get some mean emails that are people who just read the title only.
They're like, the civil rights movement was not a tragedy. It's not tragic.
Right. So people, when they use tragedy, they tend to use it as a synonym for awful, which is a bad thing. And of course, I don't mean that. There are plenty of people who do believe the civil rights movement is a bad thing.
Especially today.
Yeah, many of them are in power and you should take your objections up with them. I mean something of a term of art that comes out of tragic literature, tragic drama, tragic philosophy. And it's that, for me, tragedy means you're committed at bottom to kind of four major principles, tragic vision of life. One is that conflict, serious conflict, is enduring. Where even when we agree on things being good, we're not always likely to achieve all the things we want at the same time. Many of the good things in life will come into conflict with each other. And worse than that, we'll be in disagreement and deep antagonism about our competing ways of life, our competing values. And the idea that the romantic has that underneath our apparent discord is some kind of deep consensus, whether that's based on our national mythology or our American creed. I find that a comforting fairy tale, not an accurate grasp of social and political reality. So tragedy puts that front and center. Tragedy also, I think, makes us focus on the seriousness of defeat and death, but without dismissing things that were defeated in the past as not worthy of our reflection in the present. So there's a way in which romantic stories can tell you that because some program or project or personality didn't win, you're like, why are we talking about them at all? They were the losers of history. If they were important, they would have won. The best history, I think, really focuses in part on the people who lost, the people who were defeated, because we might learn something from their ideas, those lost possibilities, those roads not taken. Taking their vantage point as a site for our own judgment, we can enlarge our imagination of what's possible, and we can pass a different kind of judgment on what is. So much of injustice is about thinking that nothing else could be possible, thinking that this is the only way things have to be, right? Opening up that sense of contingency, roads not taken in the past, is really important, as is reckoning with the real losses of apparent victories, so that understanding that the triumphant story of romance comes with enormous sacrifice, enormous loss, the kids in Birmingham that get trotted out to do the work of civil disobedience, they are heroes, yes, but they also had to pay a cost. They risked their lives. They suffered trauma, right? I interviewed Ruby Bridges a couple years ago, and she talked about how her parents, after she integrated to school, divorced within 2 years. Their marriage couldn't survive the trauma of what they went through. And there are a million stories like that from the civil rights movement. So when people like you, DeRay, are recruiting people to participate in mass movements and protests, part of what you're doing is asking them to risk something, right? And being honest about what they're risking is so important. So for me, tragedy is about that serious conflict. It's about the importance of lingering on and reflecting on defeat. It's about rediscovering that sense of contingency. It's about taking all of those things and bringing a sense of responsibility to them. That's the fourth pillar, that the fact that these things are not guaranteed, that any outcome isn't guaranteed, isn't just license to throw your hands up and say, well, whatever, there's nothing I can do. It's to deepen your sense of responsibility that it turns on what you do. The only way to guarantee that things will get worse or that some injustice won't be remedied is for us to do nothing. Everything else is up in the air. And we have to remember that the hard-earned vision that we have now, that we can look at our society, many of us can still look at our society and see where the inequalities, the cruelties are not natural, that they are imposed, they have a history, we can name them as injustice. That was hard won. When you and I were little, people didn't talk about redlining. Ordinary people didn't talk about redlining. We lived in a city utterly structured by that. We didn't know that history. And it is possible for us to go back to a world where we don't know it, right? Without action, without speaking up, without a kind of sense of tragic responsibility that acts in the face of an unguaranteed future. So for me, that's what tragedy really means. And that's what makes it so fundamentally at odds with romance.
Is there a relationship between tragedy, romance, and Afro-pessimism? Where do the Afro-pessimists sort of fit into the conversation? Because that is very in vogue in this moment.
One of the chapters of the book is a critique of Afro-pessimism and what I call its uses of ironic history. So when romantic history is exhausted, when people don't find its stories of triumph persuasive, when they don't find its invocations of unity to have much traction as a description of the world they inhabit, when they see its politics as evasive about the kind of conflict and antagonism we're up against and unlikely to bear fruit with the forms of political judgment that it counsels, a perfectly natural response to it, or perfectly expected response to it, is a deep-seated skepticism and pessimism. So you can look at the exhaustion of romance and then turn to its opposite and say, well, not only were we not triumphant, but things haven't gotten better at all. Nothing ever moves. Not only is there no arc of the moral universe bending toward justice, there's no arc whatsoever. Everything is a straight line. One evil after another, domination in a new guise every other day. And that the idea that we should even try to engage in politics and try to transform it is foolish. That it's a waste of one's life. It's a waste of one's aims, that you're another sucker in this game of American cruelty to try your hand at changing it. So that becomes a position, particularly when you overlay it with the seeming erudition of contemporary philosophy, right? Continental philosophy. It can seem imposing and powerful, right? Because it does speak to people's sense of disorientation and suffering, and their sense that their aims have been wasted, their efforts were pointless. And so a lot of my book, I come from that school of philosophy that sees tragedy not as yet another form of pessimism, but as a response to pessimism. One, a way of thinking that allows you to confront the seriousness of the pessimist charge without falling into despair or nihilism yourself.
One of the things I've always been fascinated by, and I literally just did not learn about it in any schooling until I became an activist in this way. I didn't know about Reconstruction. It just wasn't not only did I not know it was a period, but I didn't know it was an important period. I missed it. You reference Reconstruction Reconstruction is one of the characters in the book, I would say.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the importance of the Reconstruction era in helping you think through the arguments that you make in the book?
So Reconstruction appears in the book in two main ways. The first is that the book is deeply, deeply inspired at the most fundamental level by W.E.B. Du Bois's classic study, Black Reconstruction in America. And it's a fascinating book. I encourage anybody to read it. It is the book to read along with Eric Foner's Reconstruction to understand that period. And what's so amazing about the book, among other things, is that it's actually really not a lot of original historical research in it. This is a book that is almost entirely written with secondary sources. And what he does is he reads those sources against the grain. And he says he starts with a certain set of presumptions, one of which is that Black people are human. And because he understands it starts from that fundamental conception of human equality and the dignity of Black people, he takes seriously and rediscovers, hidden throughout all of these racist representations of Reconstruction, this extraordinary movement to refound American democracy in the wake of the Civil War in a way that would permit multiracial equal citizenship, that would expand the possibilities for what we would now call a progressive American state, one that would provide public education, that would protect labor, that would redistribute wealth, provide for the ownership of land and capital for a much larger group of people, and that would play a much different role globally because it wasn't so captured by the most extreme conservative oligarchic forces in the society. So he sees the struggle of these ordinary Black people all throughout the South as this kind of splendid failure, a failure to instantiate the most egalitarian promise that inheres in American civilization. And so what it means to tell the story of a splendid failure, to linger on defeat, to open up political vision in the present, to see all of the myriad ways and complications that befell people trying to remake the world and seeing their history as a history of roads not taken, that's my book, but for the civil rights movement. So Reconstruction matters for me in that way, coming through Du Bois. It also matters to me in my rediscovery of A. Philip Randolph. So I mentioned him earlier, but for those of your listeners who don't know, A. Philip Randolph is one of the greatest Americans of the 20th century. He was originally from Florida, moved to New York, and became a writer, intellectual, newspaper publisher, and then ultimately a labor leader. And he was the organizer of the largest Black labor movement, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, and is the genius, the architect behind the March on Washington movement in the 1940s, which threatened to march on Washington, D.C. in order to ensure the integration of the trades and the military industrial jobs that had come up during World War II. And he was the architect of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in 1963. He's just a stalwart thinker of kind of left liberal vision of the civil rights movement. And he writes a lot about Reconstruction as this period where we learn some fundamental things about American history. We learn that you can't talk about civil rights without economic power, that anybody who does that is going to lead you down the wrong road because you're not going to really be able to defend your rights. The rights won't have fair value. He talks a lot about how Reconstruction teaches you about counter-revolution and the ways that a concerted action from below will bring its opposite as a response. And that you need to think through all of the dynamics of exhaustion and revolution and counter-revolution that characterized that period if you're going to understand how to prepare and make judgments for your own politics. He also teaches us that Reconstruction is, in many respects, a different kind of vision of integration. That you hear the language of integrationism in the civil rights movement, and now people think of it as actually pretty conservative or kind of narrowly liberal. That's about people just being able to like go into stores and buy stuff if they have the money, or live in whatever neighborhood they want as long as they can afford it. That's not Randolph's vision of what integration is. For him, Reconstruction is about a kind of social democratic movement where people are working together across the color line to change America in an egalitarian way. And whatever vision of integration he wants to defend in the civil rights era is the same, that the judgments aren't ones made based on kind of most narrowly negative liberal vision. It's one about expanding people's capacities for collective self-determination over all of the things that matter for their basic outcomes in life and the basic terms of their shared cooperation together. And that includes the economy.
How do you think we can use this book to help us today? Like, what is your hope for organizers and activists or practitioners and not just theorists? Shout out to the theorists, though. But what is your hope that this reframing can do, especially in a moment where, so much of the world feels like it is falling apart?
There are arguments in here that I think will be really useful about civil disobedience, about integration, about how to think through the relationship between political protest and geopolitics. So I think all of those things, those kind of concrete things, will be really useful. And I look forward to being in dialogue with people about them over the years. But even more expansive than that, there are really two things I think are utterly crucial. The first is encouraging people to rethink the exemplarity of the civil rights movement. So I borrow this term from the philosopher Immanuel Kant, that we need to move from imitation to emulation. So imitation is like when you take a great work of art and you just trace it. You copy everything in it, and then you put it out to people like, hey, aren't I a great artist? And everyone says, no, you're imitative. You didn't really tap into anything profound about the sources of creativity, kinds of questions this person was posing to produce the art that they produced. And I think there's something similar that has happened to our relationship with the civil rights movement, the way we treat its exemplarity. That many of us are just imitative. We pretend that if we do the things that we saw them do, we repeat the words that they said, we sing the songs that they sang, we will produce the same results. And one of the genius things about BLM was that it kind of opened up a space to name what many of us had already kind of recognized, that that isn't working.
Yes.
And it can open up a question. Well, why isn't it working? Well, I hope this book brings you to some of the things that, like, let's have a really serious conversation about what King was trying to do, what the SCLC was trying to do with civil disobedience. What are the questions? What are the problem spaces that brought them to the idea that an experimentation with civil disobedience was really meaningful and actionable and effective? Because once we recover the way they pose those questions, we can ask questions in a similar spirit and try to generate similar descriptions of our moment, even though our moment is radically different. We can start to ask better questions of our political practice by going through that philosophical exercise. So that's number one. Number two is trying to give people a sense that just because a romantic story has collapsed and pessimism is ascendant, those aren't the only two ways to relate to our history, right? And so really trying to give people a vocabulary, a philosophical architecture, a mode of being in the world that inhabits a totally different way of proceeding when thinking about the enduring inequalities of race in this society, as well as the enduring persistence of heroic movements against racial injustice in our history. So giving people a kind of dignified, well thought through, comparatively argued historical consciousness, I think is an important contribution, because so much of what we're doing in our politics is arguing over the meaning of that history. When people tell you why they don't want to join the protest, or why they're not going to show up for this, why they're not going to join this organization, why they think all is already lost, part of what they're doing is marshaling a history and a story about history. And there's an open question. How do you argue against that story? How do you find the words to make it compelling to defend a different kind of hope against the easy consolations of romance or the bitter cynicism and resignation of ironic pessimism? I think that's, frankly, the political and existential challenge of our time, because we're asking people now to sacrifice quite a lot in the face of an antagonism and opposition that has no qualms about the use of cruelty and has no illusions about its opposition to a great deal of what the civil rights movement genuinely stood for in its broadest sense.
Boom. Brandon, remind us of the title of the book and where people can get it.
The book is called Shattered Dreams, Infinite Hope, A Tragic Vision of the Civil Rights Movement by Brandon Terry. It's published by Harvard University Press, and you can get it anywhere books are sold, but on Harvard University Press's website or your favorite independent bookstore, just request the book.
And where should people go to stay in touch with you? Is it Twitter? Is it Facebook? Is it Instagram? Is it snail mail? Is it show up at the school? What is it?
Please don't show up at my job. No, people can best get in touch with me through email. And I'm a very reluctant user of Twitter. I tweet about once a year.
Well, we consider you a friend of the pod and can't wait to have you back.
Thank you so much, DeRay. It's always an honor to join you. And I'm really admiring of all you've done and all you continue to do. So it's great to be in conversation. I'll be back anytime.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. And don't forget to follow us at Pod Save the People and Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by Adre Moultrie and mixed by Charlotte Landis. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Miles E. Johnson and Sharon DeBossier. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.